Billy Collins is one of those rare poets, Robert Frost also comes to mind, whose work is appreciated by both serious and casual readers. His readings routinely sell out, and his books break sales records for poetry, and he served for 2 terms as the Poet Laureate of the United States, and more important to me, he's also been the Poet Laureate of New York State. His latest book, Aimless Love, contains poems from his 4 most recent collections and 51 new ones. It's published by Random House. I'm very pleased to welcome Billy Collins back to our show. Hello.
Hello. Very nice to be back here, Leonard.
On earlier visits to this show, you said the time you spend reading or walking your dog helps you develop ideas. Has that time been difficult to preserve as your popularity has grown?
Well, I think starting with the Poet Laureateship, one does get pulled out of this little private space that in which the poems are composed and thrust into the public light. The volume of my writing really, well, you wouldn't even call it volume at that point, was severely reduced in the years that I was Poet Laureate. And I began, in fact, to suspect it was some kind of government conspiracy to locate a poet who's doing very well and is prolific and then silence them by having them interviewed to death.
Are you the kind of writer who can write anywhere, or do you have to have a special space and a special time?
Anywhere. Yeah, I don't
so
have
So you can write on the subway or
write on the airplane or actually while driving, if I'm careful. I remember being...
Don't text a poem while you're driving.
No. I remember being in Ireland and driving on the other side of the road, and I couldn't write because I'm right-handed. So,
although you're listed as a distinguished professor of English at Lehman College, where you've taught for over 30 years, the school's website says you're not teaching this semester. Are you just taking a little sabbatical?
Yeah, I'm on leave and... giving me a chance to do some more writing, promote the book, and yeah.
Well, some writers complain about having to teach, but I get the feeling you have enjoyed it.
Well, I've always enjoyed it. I mean, my sense is if you're teaching on the university level, you get paid basically 2 salaries. You get a salary of money, which is certainly adequate, but then you get an enormous salary of time. You get, and I think as people get older and get more perspective on life, they see that time is not, it's not that time is money, it's that time is more important than money.
Have you come across any gifted young poets in the classroom?
I have a wonderful I think of him as a protege. His name is Colin Broderick. He's not a poet. He's a fiction writer. He has second novel just came out, and a few other people who have done okay, but there are lights that go on.
Well, I've always wondered about how that whole thing works. There were kids in my school who just seemed to be natural as poets. Just metaphors came to them easily. And then others like me who just weren't capable of doing that.
Well, I think it's interesting you put your finger on metaphor, because that's one of the unteachable qualities or abilities in poetry, is to instill in someone a desire to make odd connections, to connect dots that haven't been connected before. And if you're not interested in making these metaphoric connections, you should probably pursue some other line of work.
And that's where the flashes go off for the reader as well.
I think so, too. I think it's almost like a new synapse is burned in the head, you know, because we keep these ideas kind of compartmentalized, and here's a new association that has not been struck before. And I think that's almost a physiological thrill.
You used to require each student to memorize 14 lines of poetry. What did you feel that they would gain from that memorization?
Well, I'll give you, the gain for me was, I felt that if they didn't remember anything of my instruction, they would at least, but I was, I'll tell it quickly, but I was on the subway some years ago, and a fellow came across, sat down next to me and said, "You're Professor Collins, right?" Well, I had him as a student 15 years prior. He had since gone to medical school. He was an oncologist working in the Bronx. And he said, "You may just memorize a poem, and I'm going to say it for you." And over the rumble of the subway, he gave me an Emily Dickinson poem, and that was extremely gratifying.
Well, there was a time when everyone had to memorize poems, and people knew large swaths of Wordsworth by heart. That was always difficult for me. I only memorized one small William Blake poem, and that was because it was about art. When Sir Joshua Reynolds died, all nature was degraded. The king dropped a tear into the queen's ear, and all his pictures faded.
That's pretty good.
But that was also easy to remember because of the rhymes. Your poetry's been called accessible, but you've said you prefer the word hospitable?
Well, accessible seems to mean, in some usages of it, that the poem is easy.
So that's a put-down.
For me, it is, because I think my poems are easy in the beginning. I think it's really the development of an individual poem that's important. Accessible to me means you can step into the first few lines of the poem without obstruction. And I hope the poem gets more difficult and more demanding as it goes along.
Do you choose your poem's titles and write the first couple of lines with the idea of that welcome in mind?
It's usually an afterthought. It's usually, I'd say maybe halfway through the poem, I'll come across a title that tends to be welcoming.
And you've described the opening line of a poem as its DNA. Does everything that comes afterward have its roots in that first line?
I think so. It's almost like the key signature of the poem. It sets the tone, and the poem can swerve away from that, but it puts the poem on a certain course.
Do you understand why so many people seem to be afraid of poetry and feel that there are some poets who seem to set out to actually intimidate their readers?
Well, they're right. I mean, I think there are poets who use language as a kind of camouflage and who take advantage of knowledge that a reader just is not privy to.
My guest is Billy Collins. His latest collection of poetry is Aimless Love, New and Selected Poems. This book contains poems from four previous collections published between 2002 and 2011, Nine Horses, The Trouble with Poetry, Ballistics, and Horoscopes for the Dead, plus 51 new poems. Is it something like a greatest hits album?
Well, yeah, we don't call that in the literary world, but that's exactly what it is. If it were a Fleetwood Mac album, it would just be unashamedly called greatest hits.
And the book takes its title from a poem that was first published in Nine Horses. I've wondered about aimless love. Is all love aimless to some degree?
Well, the poem really tries to distinguish between romantic love, which is usually very intentional and is backed by motive, with another kind of love, which is a more dispassionate, aimless love, the love of the things of the world, the love of a snowstorm or a frog sitting on a lily pad.
Would you read that poem for us?
I'd be happy to. Aimless Love. This morning as I walked along the lake shore, I fell in love with a wren, and later in the day with a mouse the cat had dropped under the dining room table. In the shadows of an autumn evening, I fell for a seamstress still at her machine in the tailor's window, and later for a bowl of broth, steam rising like smoke from a naval battle. This is the best kind of love, I thought, without recompense, without gifts or unkind words, without suspicion or silence on the telephone, the love of the chestnut, the jazz cap in one hand on the wheel, no lust, no slam of the door, the love of the miniature orange tree, the clean white shirt, the hot evening shower, the highway that cuts across Florida. No waiting, no huffiness or rancor, just a twinge every now and then for the wren who had built her nest on a low branch overhanging the water, and for the dead mouse still dressed in its light brown suit. But my heart is always propped up in a field on its tripod, ready for the next arrow. After I carried the mouse by the tail to a pile of leaves in the woods, I found myself standing at the bathroom sink, gazing down affectionately at the soap, so patient and soluble, so at home in its pale green soap dish. I could feel myself falling again as I felt its turning in my wet hands and caught the scent of lavender and stone.
Billy Collins reading the title poem from his new collection, Aimless Love, love that has no lust, no Sturm und Drang.
Right, no slam of the door. It's about the kind of comparing the tempestuousness of romantic love and the psychodrama to a more cleaner, I suppose, unrequited form of the love of nature.
You've said that you tend to write each poem in a single sitting. Well, how long is that sitting?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it could be in a very short poem, which sometimes a poem just falls into your lap. It could be 10 or 15 minutes, but it's more like 3 or 4 hours.
And then revising and editing?
Revising is the wrong word for what I do after a poem is generally written, because I don't see it again anew. I don't conceptually change it. I'm basically fine-tuning. I'm probably refining would be a better word than revision. And most of the changes I'm making are for musicality or for rhythm.
Because recently Emily Dickinson's scraps of paper that she wrote on have all been collected in one space, made available on the internet. And it's amazing to see how lines change on these various scraps. You don't do that.
No, I do change. I mean, when I go from, I usually write out 2, 3, 4, 5 drafts in the same notebook. And every time I rewrite it, there are definitely scratch outs and lots of changes. But then once those 4 or 5 drafts get done in one sitting, then there's not much to do.
Did your parents write poetry?
No, my mother recited poetry a lot because she, going back to what you said earlier, had been schooled in the fine art of memorization. So she had lots of poems in her head, and the sound of poetry was alive in the house.
And do you remember the first poem you ever wrote?
I remember the circumstances. I was in the back of my parents' car. I was an only child, and all you only children out there will remember that the back of your parents' car was your terrain. You didn't have to fight with anybody.
How old were you?
Probably 8 or 9 or 10, something in there. We were driving up the FDR, as we call it now, and I saw a sailboat in the East River. And I had a literary reaction. I don't know what it was, but I asked my mother for something to write on, and I remember writing something down.
Because it was important to capture that moment?
I think it was. I think now
it's like drawing.
Yes. I mean, in hindsight, I can make up all sorts of things. Perhaps I was struck by I had an early sense of juxtaposition.
I've always been curious about why so many poets wind up writing art criticism. And I wonder if it is because there is that desire to capture that thing and preserve it.
That's possible. I mean, I associate the high watermark of poets writing that usually in the 50s and the 60s when abstract expressionist painters and poets were socially very intimate.
Although you have had poems published in magazines, and you published 2 early collections. You've said that your career really started with the publication of The Apple That Astonished Paris in 1988, when you were already in your 40s. What separated the poems in that book from the ones you'd written earlier?
Well, I sent a manuscript of poems down to Miller Williams. He was the editor at the University of Arkansas Press, and he sent them back with a paperclip around about 17 of them. And he said, these are good poems. If you can write more like this, I'll publish your book. And that paperclip was worth an MFA degree.
You understood why he had chosen those rather than the others?
I did. And I don't know if I can articulate it now, but they were just better, and I threw all the other ones out.
When you write poems, do you think of them as being standalones or as part of a collection?
Oh, completely standalones, yeah. I mean, the collection just comes about when the standalone poems have reached some kind of critical mass, and it looks like this could be a book.
You told the New York Times 10 years ago that one of the ridiculous aspects of being a poet is the huge gulf between how seriously poets take themselves and how generally poets are ignored by everybody else. Well, you haven't been ignored. Do you think that's because you don't appear to take yourself all that seriously?
Well, I've had 10 years to work on it, too, now, Leonard. Possibly. I mean, I think maybe one reason I use humor in my poems is that I don't want people to see how seriously I'm actually taking myself.
Well, you've said that you've been a big fan of Merry Melodies and Looney Tunes cartoons for most of your life, and that's evident in one of your new poems. I'm going to ask you to read it. We're fast running out of time, but I really want to get this in because it's so charming. It's called Lesson for the Day.
Very good. Lesson for the Day. I didn't know Marianne Moore had written a little ode to a steamroller until this morning. She has it walking back and forth over the particles it has crushed. She must have watched a lot of cartoons. She also compares it to a butterfly unflatteringly. I like it better when she speaks to a snail. It's pleasurable to picture her in a garden, bending forward in her dated black clothes and her tilted black triangle of a hat, as she seriously addresses the little fellow curled in its shell. But when I see her standing before the big drum of a steamroller and saying not very nice things, only one eventuality ever comes to mind, for I too am a serious student of cartoons. And no one wants to avoid seeing a flattened Marianne Moore hanging out to dry on a clothesline or propped up as a display in a store window more than I.
Do you wish Marianne Moore could have read that poem?
Not really.
The final poem in the collection is The Names, which you wrote for the victims of September 11th and their survivors. That was right before you became the poet laureate?
I was poet laureate then, actually. Yeah, it was the first anniversary. In fact, I became poet laureate about 3 months before 9/11, and the poem was to commemorate the first anniversary.
But you say initially you didn't intend to publish that poem.
Well, I didn't, and it was published in the New York Times the day I read it, and I didn't want to make it part of my shtick or whatever. I just didn't want to throw it in with other poems. I thought it was very special. But this is a new and selected book, The Aimless Love. It's a big book, probably maybe my last big book. And I thought, why not put it in as the last poem?
Are you ever surprised by how critics or just regular readers interpret what you've written?
Well, you know, you can get a good review for the wrong reasons, and you can get a bad review for the wrong reasons. What you're looking for is a good review for the right reasons. So I'm never surprised at anything that anyone says.
So you're grateful when you read a review that where the person obviously has understood what you were about.
Yeah, and I don't think a review can really kill a book of mine at this point.
Billy Collins is the author of 10 collections of poetry. The most recent one, the one we've been discussing, is called Aimless Love, New and Selected Poems. It is published by Random House. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show again.
Pleasure to talk to you, Leonard. Thank you.